This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. And we talk a lot about local food on this show and on this station, for sure. It's discussed in so many cookbooks, too, and in our food dialogue today. However, I, for one, can't really start my day without a cup of coffee or tea, perhaps. And I know a lot of other people feel the same way. Today we'll be talking all about why all the complex reasons behind our cravings for such things as coffee or tea or whatever we are craving in our diet as a society, and how much of it has been greatly shaped by the aspirations of political tensions and dependencies and power dynamics of the British Empire. Today I'm joined by the author of Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. And it's a book that traces 20 meals over the course of about 500 years in history over the British Empire, and how these stories have greatly set the stage for the modern Western diet, and perhaps much more. I'm joined by the brilliant, acclaimed historian, Lizzie Collingham. How are you? Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Fine. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much, Lizzie. And where are you joining us from today?
My garden shed in my near Cambridge, where I work.
Cool. Thanks for speaking to us from across the pond. Glad we could get you. So let's talk a little bit about this whole overall thesis of your book. Why did you decide to sort of portray this the history of the British Empire through the lens of food and certain 20 meals?
Well, it's a really long, complicated answer.
Okay.
I always find it kind of is a bit dry. But basically, the basic idea is that the way a society secures its food supply or chooses to secure its food supply has a powerful impact on its structure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that seems really obvious if you're hunter-gatherers or, you know, those first cities in Mesopotamia, they were founded on settled agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so obvious anymore in modern societies. Modern societies are overlain by politics and economics, and they obscure the fact that food actually still structures a lot of the way we get our food
mm-hmm.
still structures a lot of our relationships. And, you know, Britain, over the 450 years that I span in the book with the empire, it started off as a more or less self-sufficient country. You know, it imported some luxuries like wine and raisins and currants. In fact, they imported so many currants from Italy that the Italians thought they were using them for dye because they couldn't believe that they could be eating so many. But basically, you got most of your food from the fields around you that
mm-hmm.
you grew yourself. But then, as the British start looking outwards and going across the seas, they go in quest of food. That's what they're looking for. The spices in the East Indies, the cod in Newfoundland, tea in China. And they start going and looking for food. And then there's a lovely story that Audrey Richards, who's an anthropologist in the
mm-hmm.
1930s in what's now Zambia, tells about seeing some Bemba boys from the Bemba tribe playing.
Bemba boys.
And one of them is mm-hmm. pretending to be the white master. They're pretending to be white Europeans. And he's sort of lounging around in a tangle of rope and pretending to be a chair. And he says, oh, bring food constantly. And one of the little boys, who's pretending to be his servant, says in the end, you can't ask for food again. You know, this is just outrageous. The Bemba only ate once a day, and so because there's constant demand. And he says, "Oh, you don't know anything about white men. They say, boy, bring me food all day long." And that is a beautiful metaphor for what happened with the British, that they sat there and cried out to their emperor, bring me food. And by the first half of the 20th century, the working classes are effectively fed by the emperor. So the wheat for their bread comes from Canada, chilled beef comes from Argentina, New Zealand sends lamb and butter and cheese. And so relationship and the way their relationship with each other and the way they shop changes, the way that the British become more industrious, their relationship with the rest of the world is completely altered by this quest for food. And so that's kind of a very long answer to why I approach it that way.
It's a very big picture question. So this book covers a lot of territory, geographically and, you know, historically. It's really interesting that, you know, you write that in 1939, Britain depended on food imports more than 50% of its meat and 90% of its fats and cereals came from abroad. That's a huge change. Do you think that today's food system in America reflects or has been inspired by this global trade that they've sort of implemented or began?
Well, Britain kind of sets up, the British Empire is, you know, a huge force for globalization. It's one of the forces that creates all these food webs and webs of trade and connections between all kinds of people who aren't even aware of each other and so on. Mm-hmm. So it sets up a network which carries on. I mean, of course, in America, you know, those early 13 colonies on the coast, they all rely on that trade. So the British set up plantations in America because they want them to produce tobacco and sugar in the West Indies and foods that they can use, raw materials, and then they become places where they can send their manufacturers to. I mean, at one point, even tombstones in America were being imported from Britain.
Right.
So it's about trade and global reach. I mean, I think America, in many ways, can be self-sufficient because it has such a wide climate and a variety of foods that can grow within its own national borders. But it also looks outwards and trades, you know, lots of foods and more. I mean, you get these crazy things where people import in Belize, for example, they import tapioca in packets from somewhere else, despite the fact that cassava, which is what tapioca is made of, grows in the forest. And so I think America also has that crazy thing where you're importing foods and exporting foods, and it's sort of become very jumbled.
It's
and
messed
there
up.
Isn't a very direct line anymore between
you see
what
that.
We eat, what we grow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the British Empire starts that.
Yeah, it is ironic. You see that irony in America's farmlands where there's no local food that is accessible. There's, you know, only big supermarkets with like Chilean grown, you know, avocados or...
Exactly. I think it sort of gets... And in some cases, I mean, certainly in Britain, it's you know, it can be better for you if you... It can be better for the environment if you import your tomatoes that are grown in the sunshine in Spain rather than growing tomatoes in Britain, which have to be under a glass house. And so you're using up more oil, actually, if you grow them at home. But then there are, you know, I don't know, do they eat Chilean avocados in California where you could produce? It's kind of
avocados
this crazy
are kind of a
system.
Yeah, a crazy system right now in themselves. That's another whole topic. So, Lizzie, a lot of us think of, you know, the British Empire trading mostly like the raison d'etre of it being, you know, things like spices and sugar and silk and tea and things that that just sound irresistible, right, to a rich, you know, British classes. But you write that it actually began, the British Empire began with salt cod from Newfoundland, which doesn't sound quite as exciting to me.
No, exactly. That's why I started off, because it isn't exciting. I mean, the quest for spices and the journey to India and all of those sort of things, that's all very exciting, and this sort of foreign land you encounter. But actually, the basis for this was laid down by those West Country fishermen who started mm-hmm. going to across the Atlantic on a regular basis. So they'd go in the spring, set up fishing stations on the coast of Newfoundland, fish cod all summer, dry it and cure it with salt, and mm-hmm. bring it back. And I mean, they partly found the cod because they were looking for a sea route and to the East Indies, and that was one of the ways, you know, they kept on exploring which direction would take us to the Indies, and so that's how they came across the cod in Newfoundland. And then, of course, it became apparent that this was, people describe when they first arrived there that you couldn't actually row through the cod. The sea was so thick with cod, you couldn't very easily move forward in your rowing boat.
Oh my gosh.
And so, you know, it obviously was a huge resource, and cod was very, very good for, because it was dry, mm-hmm. you could keep it, you could feed it to sailors, because it would stay on the ships for a long journey, or you could feed it to the soldiers, especially the military forces, the Tudor forces in Elizabethan Ireland, who were putting down the rebellions in Ireland, were fed on salt cod. And so salt cod became an incredibly useful military food, and also the Mediterranean people, they absolutely loved cod. So you could exchange your cod for wine, and the British wanted to drink the wine and the olive oil. And so they found this medium for exchanging. So this Newfoundland cod trade set up all kinds of things. It taught them how it created this fund of people who knew how to navigate the seas, and for whom it was quite normal to sail across the Atlantic. It was kind of a scary thing to do at that time. And then it also created this sense that that was a good way to trade, that you got some goods, but you could exchange them for other goods, and it became a network rather than just a two-way exchange. And so they learned lots of skills
And folks had an appreciation for wine now from the Mediterranean after trading.
Absolutely. And it was called sack wine, which I really think is lovely, because that's it's a garbled version of what the Spanish called their not very good wine they sold for export.
So many fascinating connections you made here. there's so much to talk about, but let's turn to the colonies for a second.
Okay.
Let's talk jambalaya. You write how the African slaves taught South American colonists how to grow rice, and that
in Carolina. Yeah, well, I mean that's based on some very, very careful, good research by two historians, Judith mm-hmm. Carney and Richard Rosimoff, and they demonstrate the way in which African foodstuffs came across the Atlantic because of the slave trade, and that's amazing. So when the first colonists in South Carolina arrived there, they wanted to actually grow sugar, but sugar won't grow in South Carolina. It's hopeless. So they were looking for a cash crop to make money with, and they had, obviously, they bought slaves. At that point, the West African slave trade was, really at its height, and so a lot of these people, there was an incredibly sophisticated way of growing rice on the West African coast, and you'd make all these dikes and ditches, and you could use the tidal flow of water on tidal rivers to mm-hmm. flood and irrigate the fields. And so they brought that technology over, and they showed the planters how to do this, and started, and they picked up on all of this. They employed slaves who came from that area, and started to grow rice, and that made South Carolina planters the richest of all the American colonists. They were the wealthiest, and it basically, in effect,
talk about a cash crop.
And the slave trade totally denuded the labor on the West African coast, and so it dies away and fades away. So it's they kind of lift up this whole agricultural technology and bring it over.
And now we have rice.
Exactly. And you have, the boil in the bag. Is it called
Carolina.
Uncle Ben's still in America?
Yes, we have Uncle Ben's, and there's Carolina is a popular brand of rice here, too.
Yeah.
So, on the other hand, New Englanders sort of like to present themselves as free of slave labor. However, you write that they are actually, they were incredibly dependent on slave labor in the West Indies.
Yeah, I mean, New Englanders, a lot of the people who came to New England, their first settlers, were more middle class than other immigrants, and they were in search of the yeoman dream. They wanted to go to America and have their own land and become independent farmers.
Right.
So that was the dream. And a lot of them, and then, so when New England finally went through its starvation period, and they struggled along, you know, they couldn't plow the fields and dig up the tree roots and grow wheat because it kept on getting rust, and they ended up eating maize, which they regarded as pig food and was kind of embarrassing. And so when they finally got through that really difficult period and were more or less self-sufficient in their food, they could actually feed themselves. They were very, very proud of this. But actually, what New England wealth was founded on was exporting timber and shingles and tar and salt beef and salt cod, which they were catching by now off the American coast, and that was all sold to the West Indies, which was growing sugar with slave labor. And then, of course, they got sugar and molasses back. And so, in effect, what happened was that the New England economy became symbiotic with that slave labor based economy in the West Indies. And so it doesn't look as though there are any slaves supporting New England farmers, but actually their wealth is founded on selling goods to people whose wealth is founded. And in fact, is founded on slave labor. And if you follow that, you know, that expression, follow the money. If you follow the sugar in the first, or follow the money in the first British Empire that's based on the Americas, it almost every transaction you can follow, it always comes back to sugar. It's always sugar.
Wow.
Sugar becomes this incredible engine of trade and economy and movement of people, and it's quite powerful. It's amazing that this little white granule has become such a powerful force.
Right, and slave labor too, it seems.
Yeah.
I wonder how relevant that is today when we think that, you know, maybe not our wealth is founded on slave labor. Or, you know, people talk a lot about like the sweatshops situations migrant workers who are, you know, in all kinds of agricultural industries that are treated almost like slaves. So,
well, you have to think about, where's your food grown? Mm-hmm. Who's growing it? Whose land are you exploiting in order to grow it? Who's being denied water? There's a lot of power, you know, it makes you think about what you're actually. If you think about where your food is coming from, how you as a nation are securing your food supply, this, you know, it does make you think.
Yeah, I mean, and follow the sugar. That's a new. I'm going to try that. I'm going to try to attempt it. We have many more topics to cover, from India Pale Ale to Madeira wine and so forth, but we're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude and be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
All right, we're back on Eat Your Words, chatting with author Lizzie Cullingham, the author of Taste of Empire. And Lizzie, you are also the author of a book called Curry and Taste of War, which I can only imagine are also similarly fascinating yet fun historical narrative nonfiction.
Curry is a fun story. It's lovely to look at. I mean, it's about relationship between the British and India, and how the British in a way appropriate Indian food. So they love Indian food when they first get there. They bring it home and they do terrible things to it. Actually, they cut corners, and instead of having fresh spices all individually ground and roasted, they invent curry powder, which is kind of just a mix that you keep in the cupboard. It's a kind of industrial food, and that they use that in their curries, and curries become this sort of other British kind of spicy casserole instead of a real Indian. And the taste of war is a bit more depressing. It's about food as a weapon and a strategic weapon in war, and it's about how, for example, 60% of the Japanese soldiers who are recorded as having died in combat probably died of starvation and malnutrition-related diseases. And so it's those kinds of facts and figures that I explore in that.
Wow. Let's go back to curry for a second, because I know that that's a dish that many British hold dear as a comfort food and a national dish. And yet, I'm glad you mentioned like all the adaptations that they've taken the liberty of making with the traditional versions. What do you call that? Is there a word for when something has been sort of adopted by another culture and then sort of change beyond recognition?
I guess you would. Often the term academics would use, they'd say it was appropriated.
Appropriate.
But that implies something kind of sinister as well.
Yeah.
And I mean, in some ways it was kind of sinister. It was typical British to get, march around and take other people's land and other people's food and take it home and then do some terrible things to it. So in a way it is an appropriation. But, the same thing happens, curry changes. Yeah. Indian food change. I mean, curry isn't even an Indian word. No self-respecting Indian would tell you that they're going to eat a curry. I mean, they might use it now, but they're politely telling us because they know that that's how we think of their food. But it's the British said, "What are you eating?" when they arrived in India, and the Portuguese had already done the same thing and picked up Indian words, and the curry and caril and stuff. And so they started and the British picked that up and then started calling it curry.
Yeah.
And so that's how we've come to call Indian food curry, but that's not what Indians think they're eating.
Right.
They think they're eating the specific dish, a Rogan Josh or dal or whatever. So curry in itself is a kind of a British invention, just the very time. And so, but that happens to foods all the time.
They get
picked up, taken somewhere else, changed a little bit.
And yet we know of curry as curry, and yet we have this kind of skewed perception of Indian food, and many others do because of this sort of perception from the British Empire that they had of it.
It's about how curry, moves around the globe. And it often moved. It either moved with the British, so it arrives in Japan with on P&O ferries. So that's a kind of British version of curry. And then, in Japan, curry really is the ultimate comfort food. And they sell these weird kind of
golden curry
dissolved in water.
Yep.
And that's taking it even further, the British version of curry powder and so on. But it also moves with indentured laborers. So when slavery is abolished in 1838, and the sugar plantations take a terrible hit as a result, they start looking for other forms of labor, and they turn first to Chinese and then to Indian landless poor and export them around the world in return for sort of £5 a month and some food and a place to live. They employ them on the sugar plantations. And so indentured laborers end up in Guyana, in Fiji, in the Caribbean, and they take Indian food around the globe with them. But the point often, the British, instead of supplying these people with separate spices, they supply them with curry powder. And so the way Indian curries turn out in Indian hands in Guyana is this sort of simplified version of Indian food, because that's all they've got to work with. So it's an incredibly complicated story. I mean, every meal you I wrote the book through meals because mm-hmm. every time you take a meal and unpack it and look at how is it possible, how is this meal, what circumstances came together, food and meals carry such a lot of history in them. And so that's why I tried to approach it that way, because so this incredibly complex story and processes come down to one thing which you can really relate to. You can really see how, this is how it works out in up in these people's lives.
Wow. I need to take you around, and whenever I'm having a dinner conversation with folks and the topic of cultural appropriation comes up and have you kind of chime in, it is very much more, it's not as simple as just saying, you know, this is an interpretation. There are so many reasons behind it.
Exactly. It carries a history mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. within it. And, you know, people talk about, oh, is this an authentic meal that I'm eating? Well, you think, well, if it's in Britain and it's made in by an Indian chef, a Bangladeshi chef normally, in an Indian restaurant, it's authentic in those terms. It's authentic to that. It's not mm-hmm. authentic in terms of what, that, you know, people might be eating in Bombay today, but that's, you can't.
There's so many layers.
Who doesn't travel around the world like that?
So many layers of authenticity. Lizzie, I'm curious how you got into this. You're an associate fellow at the University of Warwick. And, you know, why food? Why did you decide to kind of study food so much in your history?
Well, I guess studies? I started off as a cultural historian of the mm-hmm. body. So I wrote a PhD on the British body in India and how you use your body as a symbol of prestige. And so they're very interesting, the British. When they first arrive in India, they want to fit in and they make themselves as Indian as possible. They wear pajamas, smoke hookahs, they have Indian mistresses and children with them. And it's a very different atmosphere. And as time goes on and they become more and more conscious of themselves as civilizers bringing British civilization to India, they become more and more fixated on the idea that they should be proper British gentlemen and demonstrate British values, and they start wearing black suits and eating British food instead of eating their lovely curries. So you have this weird thing that the British in India in the end of the 19th century, wouldn't put a curry on the table, whereas back in Britain, weird. People are saying, oh, a dinner party isn't complete with curry on the table.
Right.
So that's how I started off. I started off by looking at what happened to the British, it led me into food. And from then on, food is such a good way to get people to see how all kinds of interesting historical processes mm-hmm. work.
Yeah.
And so I've stuck with food. And it makes you think about things in an unusual way. I never would have thought about the Second World War. I would never have thought that food and the food supply and the security of a food supply actually pushed Germany and Japan into aggression. And is one of the, people often mistake me for thinking that food is the only driving force. I'm not arguing that for a minute, uh-huh. but what I think is that food can be a very interesting strand to follow.
Yes.
And it shows how much impact often unobserved, unnoticed, powerful driving force in history. And so that's kind of why I've got interested in it.
Yeah, and it's something we engage in every day and sort of take for granted. And our attitudes around food change so much. So I thought it was really interesting, and I know we don't have that much time, but you uncover the changing attitudes towards sugar. And at first it was thought of as this perfect food in Britain, and then tides were turned, and then it was like this horrible poison, like where we are now.
Sugar is really interesting. So in humoral theory, if you sprinkle sugar on bacon and eggs even, it will make it into a perfect food for any humor, a choleric person, a sanguine person, a melancholic, anybody
can
eat it and it'll be good for you and keep your body in balance. And then they start worrying as more and more sugar comes in, people get gout and corpulent and teeth decay and so on. They start worrying about it. And some 18th century doctors suggest that if you put sugar in a herbal infusion, that's something bitter, it might be a better way of imbibing it. And
that, I think, is how
people came to put sugar in their tea.
Ah, makes the medicine go down, or the tea.
Yeah.
And it was... Yeah.
He becomes popular, I think. I mean, and you know, it's difficult to demonstrate this with, you know, but because it's seen as a healthy and responsible and good way to eat the sugar, and the British were obsessed with sugar. They loved sugar, that, you know, of all the European. And then sugar becomes very important in the rural labourers' diets and goes into the industrial slums. And you know, industrial revolution is really founded on sugar. Sugar gives workers 15% of their energy.
Yes.
And that's an enormous amount.
It is important.
Yeah, and that diet also is taken, is picked up and taken by the British Empire all around the world. It goes into the, you know, America's industrial cities.
Right.
That's, everybody eats bread, sugar, sugary tea, and so that's how sugar kind of infiltrates and becomes a basic need, what we think of as a basic need.
Yeah.
And during the Second World War, it was rationed. It, you know, you should have just cut out sugar. You didn't need sugar, but people relied on it so much that the idea was that you had to ration it because it has become a basic food. And now we've got this problem that we rely on it. I mean, today's teenagers in Britain, and I'm sure in America too, eat the same amount. They eat 15% of their calories come from sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So it's become this incredibly damaging basic source of energy, which carries no nutrients.
I see so many like parallels to what's going on today. So, you know, soda, you could think of that as like an empire in its own, you know, going around the world for that sugary fix. Oh,
yeah.
Well, so much fun, Lizzie. I'm so glad that you could join us to speak with us about all sorts of things. But it really is a fascinating book, and I hope everyone dives in. It is, you know, it's a fun but a really, really fascinating historical account of food. So everyone check out Taste of Empire by Lizzie Collingham. And Lizzie, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
All right. And thanks everyone at Heritage Radio. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Ooh, I like the way you do.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.